The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The president has no use for Congress, apparently, on the issue of gun control, and claims he can go around it to impose some tough gun regulations.
I'm not on the ballot again. I'm not looking to score some points. I think we can disagree without impugning other people's motives or without being disagreeable. We don't need to be talking past one another, but we do have to feel a sense of urgency about it. In Dr. King's words, we need to feel the fierce urgency of now, because people are dying. And the constant excuses for inaction no longer do. No longer suffice. That's why we're here today. Not to debate the last mass shooting, but to do something to try to prevent the next one.
Whatever the impact on gun violence, the president's longstanding position on limiting the availability of guns has already made him the gun boom president, perhaps of all time. Look at Smith & Wesson's stock, up 850% since President Obama took office. The president will introduce new language into the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives definition of what constitutes a gun business, essentially requiring sellers who do business on the internet and at gun shows to be licensed and forcing them to conduct background checks on buyers. Mark Kleiman is a professor of public policy at New York University's Marin Institute. Mark, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Is it the case that the president is going into the enabling legislation of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives and tweaking that definition and then using it to say, all right, we're going to impose these regulations on these businesses?
Well, what the statute says is that if you're engaged in the business of selling firearms, you need a license. And if you have a license, you have to conduct a background check. What the president's doing is changing the definition of who's engaged in the business. Right now, somebody can sell at gun shows constantly and say, oh, no, this is just my hobby. No, I'm just selling for my private collection. So they're changing the rules to make sure that anybody who's actually in the business is defined as being in the business. And therefore, the key thing is has to do a background check. Right now, the law says if you're a convicted felon or some other categories, you can't own a gun and you can't buy a gun. And a licensed gun seller has to check your name against a register to make sure that you're eligible to buy before he sells it to you. But if you go to a private seller, whether at a gun show or someplace else, then that person doesn't have to do a background check. So that's a way that someone who's forbidden to get a firearm can actually get a firearm. And that's what the president's cracking down on.
How would this be enforceable? Would the license be revocable? Would then the individual not be able to show up at a gun show? Gun shows, it seems to me, don't particularly care about the paperwork of the individuals who come and set their wares up on tables.
Well, selling a firearm, not getting a firearm license when you're required to, carry some criminal penalties. And selling without doing a background check if you have a license carries some criminal penalties. And so that would be the enforcement.
Who keeps track of the background checks and whether they're done or not?
The background check system runs through the FBI. And the dealer has to keep a record of every sale and show that the background check was done. Again, that's part of what you get when you're a federal firearms licensee. I'm sure there will be some scofflaws who keep selling without getting a license, and then there'll have to be enforcement action against them.
If Congress takes issue with this on separation of powers grounds or Second Amendment grounds, whatever, do they have to pass a law which essentially says never mind what the president just announced on TV, or does the Congress actually have to go into the definition of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives enabling legislation and amend it to say that this definition means this and only this?
Right. So they could amend the statute to better define what it means to be engaged in the business, and that would clearly be within their power, and it would be within the president's power to veto that legislation. They could also mess with the appropriations bill. So they could say the next time money is appropriated for BATF, you can't spend any money to implement this executive action. That would probably happen after the executive action already happened. So, look, there are ways to get at it. The Senate could refuse to confirm the next director appointed to be ATF. That's one of the things that the NRA has been doing for several years, making sure that agency doesn't have any leadership, and then they're able to criticize it for not having any leadership.
Finally, isn't it the case that regulations and definitions are put up for public comment and the normal laws are passed and then there's public comment and then there's a process? Would the president be violating that process by going in and just sort of tweaking it on his own without having the public comment?
As far as I can tell, there's no proposal to do that. I mean, I assume what's going to happen is that BATF will publish a notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register. There'll be 60 days for public comment. There'll be 30 days for the agency to respond. Then there'll be a lawsuit. Both on substantive grounds and on procedural grounds, and the D.C. Circuit will have to decide it. But this seems to me so clearly within executive power that that seems not like an issue. It's also, I think, extraordinarily politically astute of the president to pick an issue. I mean, he'd proposed this as legislation, not just to redefine who's a gun seller, but to say – everybody who sells a gun has to do a background check. So if you're a private seller, you want to sell to me, we both have to go to a gun dealer and have the background check done. That didn't go through Congress, even though it has about 90% public support. So now the president has done something that he can do within his own powers. Every Republican presidential candidate is denouncing it and promising to undo it. The Congress is probably going to try and do something about it. And 90% of the population wants it done. So that seems to me reasonably clever.
Mark Kleiman is professor of public policy at the NYU Marin Institute. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
So if you could wave a magic wand, what changes, if any, do you want to see in U.S. gun laws? Austin, Texas, I would like to see every weapon in America registered. Each gun owner would be 100% responsible for anything that happened with their gun until such a time as they can legally transfer it to another. I'm not asking to remove any guns from people, just hold them responsible for the weapons they already own.
My name's John, and I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. We need to severely enforce the laws we already have, punish the criminals, not their tools.
We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org. There's public land, and then there is the public. How a well-armed public is using a long-standing argument between the Bureau of Land Management and a family of cattle ranchers in rural Oregon to invoke a very old battle for control of western land.
We are serious about being here. We're serious about defending our rights, and we are serious about getting some things straightened out.
A man named Cliven Bundy of Nevada got in trouble with the federal government over land rights back in 2014. And that's his son, Amon, speaking to CBS News about why he and his brother have occupied federal lands in rural Oregon on behalf of some Oregon ranchers. Disputes over federal land are nothing new in the West, where 47% of the land is believed to be held by federal authorities, including the Bureau of Land Management. And plenty of Westerners on our show had something to say about that. I live in rural Washington State, one of you says. I think it's essential to describe Bundy and his sort not as nutcases, but instead as armed gangsters using nutcase ideology to justify theft of land and property. On Facebook, a different view from Fred Perry. Big government has destroyed our individual rights for 400 years, and we're not going to take it anymore. The Hammond family and its ranch near Burns, Oregon, are at the center of this dispute. Dwight and Stephen Hammond are convicted of improper burning on federal lands. They have been given a stiff prison sentence due to mandatory minimum sentencing requirements, which reversed a judge's attempt to sentence the Hammonds to basically time served. They showed up to serve their sentence at a prison in San Pedro, California this week, and through their lawyer, appeared to disavow the Bundy protest going on back home. Joining us right now is Patrick Shea, former director of the Bureau of Land Management. Patrick, as you see this, is there a protest on behalf of the Hammonds or not at this point?
Well, I certainly agree with your reader that said these were illegal gangsters. They are criminals. They ought to be prosecuted in a good law enforcement fashion, but that does not mean to have a standoff. What we need to do is see if the president couldn't exercise his executive authority as he did on the gun registration question, perhaps grant the Hammonds to commute their sentence because they have served time.
Now, do you have any sympathy with the Western ranchers who view the tax liens by the BLM on non-payment of grazing fees as an attempt to restrict their business? In the case of the Hammonds, they seem to be terribly incompetent burners on their land, but nevertheless, the U.S. government being involved doesn't necessarily improve the situation, and it certainly raised tensions here. What's your view on all that?
No, I certainly have a great deal of sympathy for people who are still earning their living off the land. I think part of the problem is the global marketplace where the price of materials, whether it's beef or cattle, have been buffeted by prices that have made living off the land very, very difficult. And you combine that with the unfair competition of these large corporate farmers that have not just 100 acres or 200 acres, but have hundreds of thousands of acres, and the price that they are able to sell their product at puts enormous pressure on these family ranchers. And so I'm very sympathetic there. But as Senator Rubio said, we are a law-abiding citizen, Ree, and we need to obey the law. You know, my relatives, the Shea Rebellion back in the 18th century, reflect what happens when you try to revolt in a society such as ours, where we have a judiciary that is generally quite well balanced, and we ought to follow the law.
So you've evoked now the Shea's Rebellion there, and there are people who talk about this as being an example of the Posse Comitatus, which goes back much farther than that even. It seems to me the Bundys want to play that card of standing in the footsteps of history here, and I'm wondering if you view them as part of this movement that's always existed in the United States of using guns and armed struggle to fight against federal government encroachment, or are they outliers? Are they trying to just get attention for themselves?
Oh, I think it's the latter. I think they've watched too many TV movies or John Wayne movies about, you know, being able to wield your gun to achieve what you want to achieve. And just as my relatives decided that they were going to rebel against a whiskey tax, these individuals are rebelling against things that they don't understand. And they use the rhetoric of patriots, but their actions are that of gangsters.
Finally, Patrick Shea, and we should note, you're a former director of the Bureau of Land Management, and so your views reflect that of the federal government as well as your own personal view. Let's just say the president does grant executive clemency and the Hammonds are released. Would you recommend that the federal government then go in and arrest the Bundys if they insist on staying on this land once the sentence has been reduced or commuted?
I'd let them sit there and isolate them until they came walking out. When I was a student and headed a sit-in, the president of the university I was at quite wisely let us sit there until we decided enough was enough and walk out. And I think if we isolate them, not have any violence, the matter will go away. I do think the Hammonds have served their time. They ought to be granted clemency. And then let's let the gangsters sit there until they decide they've had enough.
Patrick Shea is former director of the Bureau of Land Management. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The inflamed tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran over the execution of a Shiite cleric by Saudi Arabia is widening as nations take sides and the region threatens to divide along sectarian lines. The U.S. seems to be nowhere to be found on this one. The Saudis in particular have decided to just bypass the U.S. and take matters into their own hands, feeling snubbed by the U.S. for a whole variety of reasons. Robin Wright is a joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars and contributing writer for The New Yorker. Her book, Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World, made some predictions about this precise scenario. Robin, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, John.
So do you think that the sectarian divide that you've noted in your writing in many years past is coming to some sort of head here?
Well, this is one of the most precarious moments in a longstanding conflict between Shiites and Sunnis, but particularly between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And it jeopardizes not just the stability in the Gulf, but four very important peace initiatives now underway that are supposed to come to some kind of fruition this month. One is the Syrian peace talks between the government and the opposition, a critical part of fighting ISIS. the headway made by the Iraqis for the first time against ISIS, both militarily and politically, the Iran nuclear deal, which was supposed to be implemented this month, and then the Yemen peace talks, which have been very precarious since the collapse of a ceasefire on the very day that Saudi Arabia executed the Shiite cleric.
Would you say that the U.S. is mishandling this or getting used to a new Saudi role in the region? What does Secretary Kerry say about this Saudi role? Are they trying to derail all of these initiatives that you spoke of?
Secretary Kerry has been engaged in talking with both the Iranian leadership as well as his Saudi counterparts. And it's clear, though, that the United States has limited influence, ironically, perhaps a little bit more with the Iranians today than with the Saudis. You have a new king in Saudi Arabia who has taken some of his own actions, particularly using his very young son as his chief advisor, getting involved in Yemen civil strife, as well as backing some of the groups in Syria. Because of the nuclear deal, Iran and the United States actually have a means of dialogue. So the dynamics, the kind of balance of power in this confrontation has shifted a little bit.
Would you say the U.S. has abdicated some role here, that it would normally play a stronger hand? Or is this just a new reality that the U.S. is trying to get used to?
I think it's a little bit of a new reality. The United States has less influence globally, even though it is the world's major power, as we go through kind of a power shift in the 21st century, in the democratization among countries as well as within countries. And so I think there's limited influence. But the Saudis are in a precarious position because of the limited prices of oil, some of their own economic problems, and the overextension into Yemen. And of course, Iran thought this was going to be the month that sanctions would be lifted and it would be welcomed by the international community again. And suddenly, both countries face a different reality as well.
Is it your sense that Secretary Kerry saw this coming and understands that these are rapids and rocky roads ahead, and that we're going to get through this on some level?
Well, I think the United States was taken off guard by the mass execution in Saudi Arabia, even though it was aware that the prominent Shiite cleric had been sentenced to death. And I think that it was disappointed by the reaction in Iran, that it thought that Iran was under a different president, was taking a more realistic line in its relations with the international community and was not going to engage in takeovers of embassies and might have acted faster than it did. The administration has done what it can, but I think that this is where you get the international community, the Russians, the UN, and others who will also be urging both countries to try to get this back on track. The danger is it doesn't happen anytime soon.
Robin Wright is a joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars, contributing writer for The New Yorker. Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Saudi Arabia's credibility in the Muslim world comes from its riches and its custodianship of the holy sites of Mecca and Medina. It also maintains an ultra-conservative sect of Islam, Wahhabism. For the House of Saud, keeping their religious legitimacy is crucial to staying in power and crucial to its identity in the region. And that means controlling the version of the Quran that scholars can agree on. So this next story may rock the Saudi world and elsewhere. What may be the world's oldest fragments of the Quran have been found in a university library in the middle of the United Kingdom. Radiocarbon dating has found the manuscript to be at least 1,300 years old, making it among the earliest in existence. The pages of the Muslim holy text had remained unrecognized in the university library since the 1930s. David Thomas is a professor of Christianity and Islam at the University of Birmingham and is one of the researchers who identified the fragments.
It does raise a number of issues. We know that there are a number of early Qurans in existence, and when I say early, I mean dating from the 7th century. When we consider that the Prophet Muhammad died in the year 632, then the earliest Qurans date from 50, 60, 70 years after his death. The Birmingham fragments have been tested by carbon dating. The latest date that we have been given is the year 645, and that places this Quran much, much earlier than nearly every other Quran that we know of, if that dating is correct.
And that would put it in a period when associates of the Prophet Muhammad were actually attempting to create an authoritative Quran in evangelizing the Muslim religion in those very, very early days. What would you say about these fragments and that process?
If this dating is correct, and we have a Quran that dates from within about 20 years of the death of the Prophet, then we have here parts of a Quran that will have been put together during the period when the authoritative Quran, known as the Uthmanic Codex, was actually in the process of being compiled. It's generally thought that a preliminary collection of the Quran was made at the time of Abu Bakr, but then the collection that today is regarded as authentic was made during the caliphate of Uthman, and that would be dated at around 650.
And finally, you know, how did it all get to Birmingham? I mean, it's not as though the caliphs took a vacation up into the Midlands.
We don't think they ever did. No, I think you're right there. How did they get to Birmingham? Well, technically speaking, we cannot be certain how. What we do know is that these leaves appeared in Leiden in the possession of a dealer, and he offered them to one of my predecessors in the 1930s. The Birmingham leaves are almost certainly part of the same Quran that we have some fragments from in Paris, and their history are much better documented. They were brought from Egypt during the time of Napoleon, and so it's almost certain that our leaves also came from Egypt at this time, though how they were separated from the Paris leaves is open to question.
And part of the mystery that remains to be solved. David Thomas, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
David Thomas is professor of Christianity and Islam at the University of Birmingham. A single punch in a street fight takes out a pair of young lives. A 16-year-old nails a 12-year-old boy directly in the face. The 12-year-old crumples to the ground. It takes only a minute to see he's dying. Another minute, he's dead. Taurus Buchanan can never forget looking down at the lifeless face of Jacques Brown in 1994. And from that moment, Taurus stopped being a juvenile and became a caricature of a 1990s criminal monster, beloved of law and order politicians in both parties. Think Chucky from the movies crossed with an old-style gangster.
They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
There are no violent offenses that are juvenile. You rape somebody, you're an adult. You shoot somebody, you're an adult.
Hillary Clinton and Newt Gingrich on the super predator bandwagon back in 1996. Taurus Buchanan, meanwhile, went to jail for life. He's 39 today, caught in a judicial limbo as the Supreme Court has slowly rolled back the political absurdities of the 90s, declaring the death penalty and life without parole unconstitutional sentences for juveniles. But will the Supreme Court decide in 2016 to apply its earlier rulings retroactively to affect people like Taurus Buchanan? Corey Johnson is one of the writers and reporters for the Marshall Project who looked at this Taurus Buchanan case for Mother Jones Magazine. He joins us now. Corey, welcome to The Takeaway.
Glad to be here.
What can you say about Taurus Buchanan, and who's most responsible for him being in jail for life, do you think?
Taurus Buchanan was a kid who made a childlike mistake. Many people out there in your listening audience, and maybe even yourself when you were a young person, might have wrestled or had a childhood fight or called another classmate names. That's what Taurus Buchanan got caught up in. And the question becomes, what is the real role of the criminal justice system? The system tries to do what's right to try to bring healing and repair, or should the system bend towards punishment? And in Taurus's case, the system bent towards extreme punishment. It charged him as an adult. It gave him a mandatory sentence. And that one punch became a death sentence for not just Jacques Brown, but Taurus Buchanan as well. And the other thing I found that was fascinating in talking to all the participants, this case not only impacted on Taurus Buchanan, but everyone else associated with it. I talked to jurors who felt haunted by the decisions that they made in this case. I talked to the prosecutor, as you'll see in this story, who also used the word haunted. In fact, he told me that he had nightmares about this case. I talked to the family of the victim, who almost, when I in discussions, thought Taurus Buchanan was still a 16-year-old kid. It's just to illustrate how frozen they were, or they are, as a result of this case.
Speaking of regrets, in talking about the prosecutor here, why did a young African-American prosecutor use this case to actually get ahead in his own career when he was clearly victimizing an individual who grew up on the streets, who was involved in a fighting culture that perhaps needed some different message from the criminal justice system?
Well, if you talk to Tony Clayton, he would tell you that, believe it or not, Black lives matter to him, too. You know, one critique that is often levied against the criminal justice system is that sometimes when Blacks are victims, that African-Americans don't get the same kind of swift and harsh punishment that would deter the wrongdoers. And Tony Clayton said that he just had a philosophy that if you took a person of color's life, that you were going to get treated with the most severe consequences if he had anything to do with it.
Some states have actually gone ahead and applied the Supreme Court rulings retroactively, and that has affected some prisoners. Why not in this case? And what do you think the realistic chances for Taurus Buchanan are?
Well, Louisiana has a very—they embrace a tough-on-crime culture. When I had a chance to spend some time down there and talk to people, I was frankly amazed at how revered Tony Clayton was to the local town. I mean, everybody had a Tony Clayton story. And I even interviewed some people who had just come out of prison who talked about how they felt Tony Clayton was having an impact even on the young men that he put away for life. And so in that area of the country, they really value a tough approach. And so it's hard to say how lenient or how forgiving they may be. But there has been a lot of discussions about the drawback to that approach, which has kind of caused their jails and their prisons to be overburdened and has sucked up their budgets to have to deal with warehousing these inmates. And so Louisiana is an open question right now about which way they're going to go. There's a new governor. He ran on a platform of criminal justice reform and trying to ease some of the overcrowding. But he also met some attack ads. It's really hard to say which way Louisiana is going to go, but just know that they very much value the tough-on-crime approach there.
Corey Johnson is a reporter for the Marshall Project and one of the writers that looks at this Taurus Buchanan case for Mother Jones Magazine. Corey, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Medical science as we know it would never have progressed beyond leeches, toad spells, and bloodletting if unscrupulous doctors and researchers hadn't robbed graves centuries ago and stolen bodies.
You and I should work together.
You mean we would sell the bodies to the doctors together? To dig them up?
There'll be no digging. The kirkyards are too well guarded. We will, so to speak, burk them.
The Grinch himself, Boris Karloff, playing a body snatcher in the 1945 movie of the same name from a much older Robert Louis Stevenson story. The use of human tissue to advance science has always been permitted within attention of morality and privacy. Anything that may be taken from your body, for instance, in the course of surgery or a biopsy could end up in a research experiment. And in most cases, samples are anonymized, identity-free. But now the federal government wants to require that every patient consent to future research using their tissue if they need a biopsy or a blood test. Are we seeing this moral tension raising its head once again and possibly pushing back on science? Joining us to talk about this is Alta Sharo, professor of law and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin. She also served on President Bill Clinton's National Bioethics Advisory Commission. Alta, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So if I check a box on a, you know, not yet existing but soon to be existing form, which says I don't want any of my tissue to be studied, am I essentially engaging in an impulse not unlike, you know, deciding not to be an organ donor, that it's just too creepy as far as I'm concerned? Or are there valid privacy reasons, in your view, for checking such a box?
There are valid reasons, but I don't think they're nearly as compelling as people imagine, because the vast majority of this research is going to concern aggregated data. Nobody's particularly interested in looking at your background or my background. What they want is millions of backgrounds so that they can correlate what they're seeing in the tissue with what they're seeing in public health outcomes or in aggregated medical records. So that's one reason people need not be so terribly worried. The second is that even though this information is very useful in the aggregate, on an individual basis, it's remarkably not useful. Knowing your particular genetics actually doesn't tell us very much at all about you and your particular susceptibilities, except for a very narrow range of diseases that have a strong genetic component. The things that we tend to worry about, the cancers, the heart diseases, the strokes, the dementias, are all multifactorial. So having the gene sequence is not going to reveal anything about your future that is particularly useful on your individual basis.
But if we think of the Henrietta Lacks case, her tissue is still being used in research today. They've produced all kinds of medical miracles with it, but it also bespoke a certain kind of arrogance on the part of the medical community for treating the Lackses as medical specimens, not really thinking of them as a family. That was reversed by the remarkable book that was written about the case. But do you think it makes the case that medical science needs to rethink this idea that they can use any medical tissue unless somebody opts out?
Well, let's first remember that the Skloot book describes a case that could not occur under the current rules. This was not a case in which the tissues had been properly de-identified, and that's exactly why the whole family became involved in this research and, yes, was studied without any kind of personal option to participate or not. But to your deeper question about the arrogance, I think that there is a need for people generally to understand the degree to which we have a social compact here, and that all of us benefit from this research, which is why we would like to make it possible to have as much participation as we possibly can. The current rules are very protective of our interests. They make sure that if there's identifiability in those tissues, that we do get a chance to say yay or nay. It's only with unidentified tissues that scientists can use this as they wish. The tissues that are left over after a surgery and have no name, no code, no nothing attached to them are what the scientific community uses. So the better question is, do we really want to say it's arrogant for the scientific community to take advantage, essentially, of the trash that we leave behind to try to understand the nature of disease?
Finally, why is it the case that when the traffic in human tissue is revealed, as was the case in the Planned Parenthood situation of the use of fetal tissues, that it evokes such a huge response? I mean, you know, I'm tempted to say, you know, we put a man on the moon, you know, the people walk around with iPads these days. It's a very sophisticated technological society, yet the notion of tissue trafficking on any level seems to bring up some kind of throwback impulse of disgust that is really counterproductive. Why is it still there? Why is it still relevant? Why does it work?
I think there's going to be different reasons for different kinds of tissues, but you're correct that there's often a very strong public reaction when they first hear about something that they didn't completely understand was going on for years and decades. So in the case of the fetal tissue research, I think that people were completely unaware that this tissue has some kind of medical value and was being used, and had imagined that fetuses were being buried or somehow being treated the way you would any other human remains. The second fear was that somehow it was going to encourage the number of abortions, which has been disproven, but it was a concern. Similarly, when you hear people get upset as they learn about tissues from organs, or even organ transplants of whole organs, they worry that this is somehow going to affect our willingness to try and give medical care to people who are close to death. And they want to be sure that there are no such incentives to change the way we treat people medically. Those are two very different kinds of reasons. Third is when there's money involved. And years ago, there was quite a lot of outcry when people realized that various kinds of tissues like bone and skin that were being donated by families from the deceased were then being machined and manipulated into things we use for implantation to save people's lives or protect their health, but that the companies that did this very sophisticated work were making a profit. And that became the source of controversy. So having a general understanding on the part of the public about what it takes to do these things is very helpful. Francis Collins talked about making patients more participatory. That's very helpful. But it is also the case that people need to understand that the current system, which would be unchanged, is one in which anything that really reveals something about them personally still does require that they give personal permission for that use of the tissue.
Altashar is a professor of law and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin. She served on President Bill Clinton's National Bioethics Advisory Commission. Alta, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And here's something to take with you today. What does a functional morphologist do? Well, a lot of things, including apparently studying the tongues of chameleons. A paper published in Scientific Reports says that the little Rhamphalian spinosus chameleons can stick out its tongue with a force 264 times the force of gravity. So if you are a bug and are unlucky enough to be yanked into the mouth of a Rhamphalian, you will experience 264 Gs before you are gulped into oblivion. Little chameleons have faster tongues, says Christopher Anderson from Brown University. I've always been interested in chameleons since I was a kid. Well, today he's a tongue-watching functional morphologist who did his dissertation on chameleon tongue mobility. Wow, science. What a way to get away from the headlines. Give us your take at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.